It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. David Anderson as the opening speaker for the 2007 to 2008 NIH Directors Lecture Series on Wednesday afternoon. Dr. David Anderson is Roger Sperry Professor of Biology at California Institute of Technology and an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He received his bachelor's degree from Harvard with highest honors, summa cum laude, and his PhD from Rockefeller University, where he trained with Nobel laureate Gunter Globo. Dr. Anderson performed his postdoctoral studies at Columbia University with another Nobel laureate, Richard Axel. Research in Dr. Anderson's lab has always been at the forefront of neuroscience. He has made numerous fundamental contributions to our understandings of the development and function of the nervous system, including mechanisms of fate determination in neural stem cells, neural influences on angiogenesis, and circuit mechanisms underlying emotional behaviors. In recognition of his contributions to science, Dr. Anderson has received many awards and honors. To mention a few, he has been elected as a member of National Academy of Sciences, American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Fellow, and American Academy of Arts and Sciences Fellow. Today, he will be giving us a lecture on molecular analysis of neural circuits underlying emotional behaviors. Let's welcome Dr. Anderson.
Thank you, Quan. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be your inaugural wall speaker today, and nice to see familiar faces and catch up with the exciting work that's going on here. So all animals exhibit innate defensive behaviors that are critical for the survival and reproduction of the species. And the stereotype nature of these behaviors and their reproducible aspects suggest that large aspects of them are likely to be hardwired and therefore under genetic control. And so a major challenge for biology, I think, in the next decades is to understand how such innate behaviors can be wired into the genome and controlled by genetic influences. Consistent with this notion of genetically based hardwired behaviors, there's increasing evidence for genetic influences on human affective disorders that represent abnormal variants or abnormal expressions of emotional behaviors such as fear and anxiety. And I think another important goal of science in the coming decades, particularly biomedical research, is to try to use the information gained from studies of genes and circuits to improve our diagnostic and prognostic and therapeutic abilities in psychiatry. It's as a medical layperson, it's amazing to me that if one is confronted with a potential cancer diagnosis, one gets bone scans, blood tests and biopsies, and if one is confronted with a possible depression diagnosis, one gets a questionnaire. So the problem with trying to understand how genes influence behaviors is that there are too many levels of biological organization that intervene between the gene and behavior, which is an emergent property of the organism. And this general problem has typically been approached in a top-down and a bottom-up manner. The top-down approach, systems neuroscience, uses recordings of spiking activity and non-spiking activity from ensembles of neurons to try to obtain electrophysiological correlates of brain activity and behavior. But as I said, many of these types of measurements are essentially correlative in nature and therefore fall short of establishing cause and effect relationships between the activity of circuits and behavior. Molecular biology is very good at establishing cause and effect relationships between genes and cell function through loss and gain of function analysis, but again, because of the problem of layers of biological organization and also developmental time, not shown here, the phenotypes, the behavioral phenotypes that come from gene manipulations can be very indirect and difficult to decipher. So my colleagues and I, over the last several years, have endeavored to try to attack this problem at the what Christoph Koch, my colleague at Caltech, calls the meso scale, the scale in between that of microcircuits and macrocircuits, using the specificity provided by gene expression to mark and map and manipulate specific populations of neurons and to understand their relationship to behavior. And so we're interested in using such genes to measure activity in specific populations of neurons and correlate that with behavior, to inactivate these neurons to determine their necessity for specific behaviors, to activate these neurons and determine their sufficiency for behaviors, and also to map their connectivity. And with these types of approaches, we hope to be able to integrate these studies with more traditional top-down and bottom-up approaches and gain a larger picture of how genes interact with circuits to specify behavior. So some of the general issues that my lab is concerned with specifically revolve around a fundamental issue, which is how does the nervous system convert sensory representations of innately aversive stimuli into defensive behaviors such as flight or freezing? What is the relationship between circuits for learned and innate fear or avoidance? Why is it that there are some things that we seem to be innately afraid of, like spiders or snakes, and other things that we can learn to become afraid of but don't seem to be born fearful of? Are those completely different circuits or overlapping circuits? And then finally, as we gain a better understanding of the nature of these emotional circuits in the brain, we may be in a position to begin to ask how and where drugs and genes that influence fear, anxiety, and other emotional states act on these circuits. So I'm going to give you two vignettes, both incomplete because this is work in progress and the going is slow, but they will illustrate both approaches in mouse and in fly, and also what I like to call the cellular analog of forward and reverse genetics. So reverse cellular genetics is like reverse genetics. You start with a gene and move to function here by using the gene to define particular cells and circuits and ask about their roles and behavior. The forward approach is more like classical mutagenesis, where one starts with a phenotype and then uses high throughput approaches to identify cells that are important in those behaviors and then to begin to understand genes that may act in those cells to control the development and function of those circuits. And I'll start by telling you a bit about our progress in this forward approach in Drosophila, and then the second half of the talk will be spent discussing our work on fear and anxiety in the mouse. So can one actually use flies to model mood or emotion or any component of affect? I think this is one of the last areas where it's not clear whether flies will be a useful model system or not. But there have been people, even recognized authorities in biology like Charles Darwin, who have been convinced that at some level, insects are capable of expressing graded, scalable internal states that can be recognized by particular physical body movements or other types of emotional behavior. He writes here, for those who can't read it in the back, even insects express anger, terror, jealousy, and love by their stridulation. That's from his monograph on the expression of the emotions in man and animals. So now, beginning about 5 years ago, in collaboration with my colleague Seymour Benzer at Caltech, we began to investigate the question of whether flies are capable of communicating an internal state of stress to other conspecifics. And the paradigm that we used was based on some anecdotal observations that Benzer had made in the 1970s during learning and memory experiments, which suggested that when flies are electrically shocked, they may emit odors that are avoided by other flies. And so the standard apparatus that we use is a T-maze, where the flies are delivered to a choice point and then allowed to choose, in this case, a control experiment between two empty tubes. And in the next film, what you'll see is that the flies are now choosing, again, between two empty tubes, but the tube on the right previously had other flies in them that were vortexed and then immediately removed before the tube was attached to the T-maze. And you'll see that In a very short period of time, the majority of the tester flies avoid the tube that contained shaken flies. And one can quantify this, and on a good day, the performance index, which is the percentage of flies that avoid the shaken tube minus the percentage of flies that enter the shaken tube, is better than 80%, which is extremely high. So a PI of zero indicates that the flies are equally distributed. And you get a similar effect by shocking electric flies. This is not due to the deposition of fly fecal material on the wall of the tube, because if you incubate flies in the tube overnight and gently remove them by positive phototaxis, and they've had plenty of time to sully the walls of the tube, tester flies no longer do not show this avoidance behavior. And emitting this substance also requires the function of the nervous system, because if you vortex or shock genetically paralyzed flies, they do not emit this substance. And so that also rules out passive deposition of cuticular fragments or other body parts on the wall of the tube. So we provisionally named this substance Drosophila stress odorant, stress referring to the manipulations that we as scientists perform on the fly, not to the necessarily to imply any internal emotional state. It's something that the flies give off when we stress them. And by doing some preliminary gas chromatography and mass spectroscopy, Greg Hsu, the postdoc in the lab who spearheaded this work, identified one of the components of DSO as carbon dioxide. And you can see that carbon dioxide on its own is a potent repellent in the T-maze assay in a dose-dependent manner. And that we were also able to show that when flies are shaken, they increase their emission of carbon dioxide by about a factor of four. And at first, we were disappointed in this result because we were hoping for a long-chain hydrocarbon pheromone of some kind, and carbon dioxide only has one carbon, and that seemed kind of paltry. But it turns out that carbon dioxide is, of course, very important in the insect kingdom. Mosquitoes use carbon dioxide to locate their prey. And most recently, these data turn out, I think, even to be potentially relevant to mammals. Some of you may have seen a recent publication from Min-Min Luo in Beijing and his colleagues indicating that, contrary to what was previously believed, which is that mammals only detect CO2 via their carotid body and their circulatory system, that in fact mice also have a specialized olfactory system for the detection of CO2, and that detection of CO2 through the system is aversive to mice as it is to flies in a T-maze. So we were interested in trying to begin to map the cellular circuitry that underlies the avoidance of carbon dioxide, since this was a very robust behavior that could be elicited by a defined odorant. And as a first step, we teamed up with my former postdoctoral mentor, Richard Axel, and applied two-photon functional calcium imaging to identify neurons in the olfactory system that are activated by carbon dioxide, in this case using GCAMP, which is a calcium-sensitive fluorescent protein, to monitor neuronal activity. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the fly olfactory system, we are imaging in the fly's antennal lobe, which is their anatomical equivalent of the olfactory bulb. It's the first relay station inside the brain. And like the mammalian olfactory bulb, the antennal lobe contains these spherical neuropil structures that are called glomeruli. And as in the mammalian system, each of these glomeruli receives convergent input from primary olfactory sensory neurons that express a single olfactory receptor gene. Now, beautiful work from Axel's laboratory previously had shown that most odorants activate specific combinations of glomeruli in the antennal lobe, suggesting that odor quality is mapped to a first approximation on the antennal lobe as a spatial combinatorial code. So we were surprised to see that when carbon dioxide was applied to this preparation, it activated a single glomerulus, and it was the most ventral glomerulus, called the V glomerulus. And importantly, none of the other 30-some-odd odorants that were tested in their collection activated this particular glomerulus. Now, it turned out fortuitously that the neurons that innervate, or at least some of the neurons that innervate this V glomerulus, have been serendipitously identified by another former postdoc of Richard Axel's, Kristen Scott, now at Berkeley, in a screen for candidate gustatory receptor genes in the fly. And one member of this gustatory gene family turned out to be expressed in a subset of about 20 neurons in the Drosophila antenna, which could be shown to send their axons to this V. glomerulus by virtue of a membrane-bound GFP axonal tracer. So that raised the question of whether this gene, which is called GR21A and encodes a 7-transmembrane receptor, whether the neurons identified by this gene are themselves CO2 responsive. And so we use now the GR21A promoter to drive the expression of GCAMP. And you can see that carbon dioxide now activates the presynaptic terminals of these sensory neurons in the V glomerulus. So not only do these neurons project to a glomerulus that's activated by CO2, these neurons are themselves activated by CO2. And here you can see that they are activated to a greater extent by air from traumatized flies than from undisturbed flies. And very nicely, the dose response curve for activation of these neurons by carbon dioxide parallels closely the dose response curve for the behavioral activation, behavioral avoidance of carbon dioxide, which we can see at as little as about 0.1 to 0.2% over atmospheric, which is 0.0375% CO2. And I should say that since the studies were done, independent work in Leslie Vossel's lab at Rockefeller and also in John Carlson's lab at Yale have confirmed that GR21A indeed encodes a subunit of the CO2 receptor together with a second gene, GR63A. So we next wanted to know whether these neurons that respond to CO2 and are activated by air from shaken flies are actually necessary for behavioral avoidance of carbon dioxide. And to do that, we took advantage of a genetic tool which has been developed by Toshi Kitamoto in the Drosophila system and which is in widespread use. It's a temperature-sensitive dominant allele of a gene called Shibiri, which encodes the microtubule-associated protein dynamin. And this gene has the property that at the non-permissive temperature, the high temperature, it blocks vesicle recycling at the synapse. So once all the vesicles have fused and you shift the temperature, there are no more vesicles left and synaptic transmission is blocked. So this is a very useful tool because it means in flies of the same genetic background, you can compare the behavior either at the permissive temperature, 21 degrees, or at the non-permissive temperature. And so the results of these experiments are, if you look, the red is the non-permissive and the blue is the permissive temperature, and this is the avoidance in the T-maze that silencing these CO2-sensitive neurons indeed strongly inhibits behavioral avoidance of CO2 in a T-maze, and in fact reduces it to a point where it's statistically indistinguishable from two control tubes. And there are a variety of other controls using silencing other populations of olfactory sensory neurons that suggest that these neurons are unique in their requirement for CO2 avoidance. So this is a cellular loss of function experiment and demonstrates that these CO2 sensitive neurons are necessary for CO2 avoidance. More recently, we've become interested in the question of whether activation of these neurons is actually sufficient to promote CO2 avoidance. Because one could argue, for example, that although flies can smell CO2 through these neurons and that they are necessary for CO2 avoidance, that avoidance of CO2 is actually mediated in addition by some sort of respiratory detection of CO2. And so we wanted to ask the question, if we artificially stimulate CO2-sensitive neurons with a stimulus of a completely different sensory modality, would that suffice to elicit avoidance behavior from the intact fly? And to do that, we took advantage of channel rhodopsin, a tool that's been developed by Nagel initially and then by Carl Disseroth and Ed Boyden. And this is a Chlamydomonas-derived light-activated non-selective cation channel. And so what we did was to express channel rhodopsin, specifically in GR21A neurons under the control of this GR21A promoter. And what you can see in these raster plots is that blue light, 470 nanometer light now, elicits increased spiking in these CO2-sensitive neurons in a manner which is very similar to that elicited by CO2. It doesn't happen every time, and sometimes the response is not as sustained as other times, but it's clearly a light-based activation of these neurons. Other neurons in the same scintilla are not affected by the blue light in their firing. So now we wanted to know whether this would actually produce behavioral avoidance. And the way we did this is when I was on sabbatical a year and a half ago with Martin Heisenberg in the University of Würzburg. We took advantage of their precision German machinists and their machine shop to build a T-maze in which one arm of the T-maze is outfitted with blue diodes that are water-cooled. And so the question is, if you put flies that have channel rhodopsin into the CO2-sensing neurons, put them into the T-maze and flash the blue light, will the flies think that they're actually smelling carbon dioxide and avoid the blue light, which they are normally strongly attracted to in a wild-type genetic background? And indeed, what you can see is that flies that are expressing channel rhodopsin in the GR21A neurons are strongly repelled by the blue light. It's maybe not quite as strong as with CO2, but it's a very robust response. And it requires the presence of retinal, which is an obligatory cofactor for channel rhodopsin. And just to dot the I and cross the T and make sure that there was no interaction between the olfactory and visual system that was responsible for this effect, we crossed this transgene responder combination into a genetically blind background, NORP-A, which is a phosphodiesterase mutant that's required for vision. These flies are blind, and yet they avoid blue light in the T-maze, again, in a manner which is retinal dependent. So activation of these neurons is sufficient to promote avoidance of CO2. That suggests that avoidance behavior may be hardwired into the pathway that detects CO2. Now, this brings up an interesting and controversial conceptual issue in the field of olfactory coding, and that is that the data that I have presented to you so far are consistent with the idea that CO2 avoidance, at least, may be mediated by some kind of a labeled line, a dedicated circuit for translating CO2 detection into avoidance. There is, however, a body of evidence, including beautiful work from my colleague Gilles Laurent at Caltech and his former student Rachel Wilson at Harvard, that suggests that lateral interactions between different projection neurons in the antennal lobe may be important in distributing information in a way that is critical to olfactory information coding. And in this view, particular sensory stimuli would be represented by overlapping combinations of receptor channels, and that information would in some way be combined and integrated to produce either approach or avoidance responses. So we wanted to know whether this type of mechanism might be operative in the case of CO2 avoidance. And we took advantage of the fact that there is a Gal-4 line, GH146, which has been shown to express in the majority of projection neurons that innervate the antennal lobe, except that, fortuitously, it does not express in projection neurons that innervate the V glomerulus, the carbon dioxide-sensing glomerulus. So we use this GH146 Gal-4 line to drive Shabiri and silence all of these other projection neurons in the antennal lobe, and what you can see is that this silencing has no effect on avoidance of carbon dioxide. So this is, of course, a negative result and has to be taken with caution, but in contrast to the results obtained with silencing of the CO2-sensitive ORNs, that suggests that these other PNs do not play a significant functional role in mediating the transmission of the CO2 signal. So from that standpoint, it may be the case that the detection of CO2 represents a type of labeled line system. Now, this is not necessarily incompatible or inconsistent with the distributed coding model. And one way of thinking about this is that the olfactory system may have two branches that are analogous to the two branches of the immune system, very loosely analogous, the innate and the adaptive branch of those two systems, where the innate olfactory system has evolved to rapidly elicit robust genetically programmed behaviors that are critical for the survival of the organism, whereas the adaptive part of the system has evolved to permit recognition of novel odorants that the species may not previously have encountered during evolution, and to learn or develop novel and appropriate behavioral responses. Now, I'd just like to touch briefly on the question of the relationship between circuits for innate avoidance and learned avoidance, because that was one of the issues mentioned at the beginning of the talk. So avoidance of CO2 does not require learning. It's an innate behavior. What's the relationship of the circuits that underlie innate CO2 avoidance to those that underlie learned avoidance? As many of you know, in experiments pioneered by Seymour Benzer and continued by Tim Tully and Martin Heisenberg, it's been possible to show that flies are capable of learning to associate an odor with an electric shock and avoid it. So the way this type of experiment works is that the flies are introduced with odor A in a training chamber, and they get a shock in the presence of that odor. And then the flies are transferred to the choice point and allowed to choose between odor A and odor B. And when the training works, the majority of the flies avoid odor A in favor of odor B. And a large body of work from many labs has shown that the mushroom body is a structure that is important in learning the associations between the odor and the shock. And indeed, many of the projection neurons, the olfactory projection neurons, send collateral branches into the mushroom body as well as into the lateral horn of the protocerebrum. And so we were interested in asking whether the mushroom body is necessary for avoidance of carbon dioxide. And the way that we did that was to ablate the mushroom body, either chemically or genetically. In this example, we've ablated it chemically using an old trick of hydroxyurea treatment to kill the mitotic progenitors of mushroom body neurons during a specific critical period during development, and using a Gal-4 line to show that the mushroom body is killed and other populations of neurons are intact. And what you can see is that this hydroxyurea treatment has no effect on avoidance learning in this case, benzaldehyde, whereas it does it has no effect on CO2 avoidance, whereas it does have an effect on learned avoidance of benzaldehyde in this positive control experiment. This is a variant where we genetically silence the mushroom body using Shibiri, and again, there's no impairment of CO2 avoidance as well. So that suggests that the mushroom body is important in learned avoidance, but is not required at least for innate avoidance of carbon dioxide. So that made us interested in the question of whether the projection neurons that mediate the response to carbon dioxide innervate the mushroom body or just project directly to the lateral horn. And to do that, again, we collaborated with Richard Axel, taking advantage of a recombinase-based technique for sparse labeling of subsets of neurons within the brain of flies that express a particular Gal-4 driver. And in this case, we were aided by Kei Ito, our collaborator in Japan, who identified a Gal-4 line that labeled about 50 neurons, including, he thought, neurons that innervated the V. glomerulus. And in a small number of organisms in which just a single neuron among these 50 was labeled, we were able to visualize the projections of a second order neuron innervating the V. glomerulus. And what you can see is that that neuron projects up to the lateral horn without sending any collaterals to the mushroom body and terminates in this characteristic crescent shape. Now, there are other projection neurons that innervate V, and some of those may well innervate the mushroom body, but it's interesting in the context of the mushroom body not being required for learning that this projection neuron at least bypasses the mushroom body. And we're now interested in identifying these other classes of projection neurons, as well as trying to identify downstream third-order neurons that receive input from these lateral horn neurons. So that's where we are in our studies of the Drosophila model system. And it has required development of new technology, and there are still a number of technical limitations that make progress forward not as smooth as we would like, but it's certainly a faster and more facile system than the mouse. So what I'd like to do for the remainder of the time is to talk about our work in the mouse system, and this is the so-called reverse approach, where we've started with genes that identify particular sets of neurons in brain regions that we're interested in, and then use those genes to get a handle on particular neuronal populations, and then ask about their role in behavior, specifically in fear and anxiety. So most of you are familiar with fear conditioning. It's one of the most robust paradigms for associative learning in the mouse. In this paradigm, an animal is exposed to a tone followed by a foot shock and learns that the tone predicts the arrival of the foot shock, so that the next day when the animal is confronted with the tone, the animal exhibits a species-typical defensive behavior, which in this case is freezing. And large bodies of work from Joe Ledoux, Michael Davis, and Mike Fancelo have worked out much of the basic circuitry involved in this associative learning, particularly that which concerns the amygdala, medial temporal lobe structure. It's been shown that the lateral nucleus of the amygdala, which by the way contains at least 12 distinct subdivisions, but the tip of the lateral nucleus appears to be the site of convergence between the conditioned stimulus and the unconditional stimulus, and that LTP occurs in this location, and that information from that association site is thought to be relayed in some manner to the central nucleus of the amygdala, which is a site of coordinated output for this structure and which drives behavioral, autonomic, and endocrine manifestations of conditioned fear. And that's supported by early studies indicating that lesioning of the amygdala central nucleus can block all of these different readouts of conditioned fear. But in recent years, the story has become more complicated, in part because many of these early lesion experiments were based on electrolytic lesions, which are capable of damaging fibers of passage, as well as local neuronal cell bodies. And in fact, within the last couple of years, there are two studies which for the first time perform bilateral stereotaxic injections of excitotoxic or inhibitory compounds into the amygdala central nucleus, and which arrived at diametrically opposite results. So publication by Ku et al. In Journal of Neuroscience showed that when chemolytic ablation was performed on the central nucleus, there was no inhibition of contextual freezing. Only when electrolytic lesions of the central nucleus were performed was freezing inhibited. And then a more recent study from Joe Ledoux's laboratory showed that when Musimol, a GABAergic agonist, was infused into the central nucleus, there was indeed an inhibition of freezing. But interestingly, this inhibition was strongest when the infusion occurred immediately before the conditioning rather than after the conditioning, suggesting that the central nucleus might be involved in the acquisition of learned fear as well as in its expression. So why these conflicting data? And the reason is that the central nucleus of the amygdala is itself an extremely complicated structure. It consists of at least three subdomains: a lateral subdivision, a medial subdivision, and a central subdivision. Interestingly, the major output from the central nucleus is from the medial subdivision, but it's thought that most of the input to the central nucleus from the lateral amygdala is into the lateral component of the central nucleus, and it's not obvious how that information is relayed to the output structures. Moreover, within each of these different subdivisions, there are data suggesting the existence of multiple distinct subpopulations of neurons. So given this heterogeneity and complexity, it's not surprising that different methods for inactivating this structure might produce different results. And so we reasoned that going forward, in order to make progress in this area, it's necessary to gain genetic control over these subpopulations of neurons, and to use that genetic control to perform the type of cellular loss of function, and eventually we hope gain of function manipulations, like I described to you in the case of Drosophila. So one would like to have genes that are expressed in specific populations of central amygdala neurons and use the promoters of those genes to drive activity reporters, silencers, etc., and to have that not for just one population, but for multiple populations of neurons. So that requires that we identify genes that are expressed in the central nucleus and gain access to regulatory elements from those genes that can be used to drive the expression of these effectors, and that we also have to develop genetically encoded effector systems for measuring activity and for activating and inactivating these neurons. So our initial steps to identify markers for cells in the central nucleus were taken now some years ago by Mariella Zierlinger, a graduate student in my lab, and she performed laser capture microdissection and microarray analysis on different nuclei from the amygdala and was able to identify a small number of genes that are specifically expressed in subsets of neurons in different amygdala nuclei, such as this one in the amygdala central nucleus. Since that time, through GenSat and the Allen Brain Atlas, it's now much easier to identify additional markers for neurons within the amygdala in silico rather than doing it on the benchtop, but these markers have proven useful nonetheless. One of the markers that came out of this study was a gene called protein kinase C-delta, which turns out to be expressed in a subset of neurons within the lateral subdivision primarily of the central nucleus. And within that subdivision, it's expressed in about 50 to 60% of the cells within that region. So it's not expressed in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala or the basolateral nucleus of the amygdala, although it is expressed, as you'll see, in other regions of the brain within the amygdala itself. It's highly specific for this subset of neurons within the lateral subdivision of the central nucleus. So what we would ideally like to do is to silence these neurons and ask, what is their role in fear conditioning, to activate these neurons and ask what is their functional role, and to trace their connectivity and see how they relate to the rest of the amygdala circuitry. And in the remainder of the talk, I'll give you a progress report on our efforts along those lines. So first, silencing these neurons. At the time we began these studies, there was no system for genetically encoded silencing of neurons in mammals that functioned by suppressing electrical excitability, was gated by a ligand that crossed the blood-brain barrier, and had been validated in freely behaving animals. There have been a number of systems developed, such as the MIST system, that are based on blocking synaptic transmission, analogous to Shibiri, and those are useful, but we wanted to be able to suppress electrical activity so that we could validate silencing in the neurons that we're manipulating without having to know their postsynaptic targets a priori, and to do this in a way that would allow testing in freely behaving animals without site-specific infusion of drugs. And so my colleague at Caltech, Professor Henry Lester, came up with the idea of using a chloride channel from the nematode C. elegans, which is gated by a nemahelminthic compound called ivermectin. And the idea was to express the two subunits of this channel, GluCL alpha and GluCL beta, and then to activate it with the ligand. This would allow chloride to pass into the cell, hyperpolarizing it. And indeed, Eric Slimko, Henry's graduate student, was able to show that in dissociated cultures of hippocampal neurons, there was an extremely efficient silencing of action potential spiking by ivermectin in cells that were co-infected with viruses that expressed both the alpha and the beta subunits. And things stood at that point for a number of years while our lab struggled to see whether this system could actually be made to work in vivo. And in fact, it was only with the efforts of Walter Lerchner, a former postdoc in the lab who's now here at the NIH working in Barry Richman's group, that we were able to finally achieve a proof of principle of this system in freely behaving animals. So it was Walter's idea to test the system by stereotaxic injection of viruses encoding the two subunits of the channel into the striatum, which is a large target, one that's relatively easy to hit, and where one gets fairly good spread of the virus. And the idea was that after injecting the virus, one would give the animals ivermectin, and then after various periods of time, give amphetamine, which, as most of you know, promotes dopamine release from striatal nigral afferents to the striatum. And what typically happens in animals which have unilateral lesions in the striatum that interfere with dopaminergic transmission is that amphetamine causes a rotation of the animals in the direction which is ipsilateral to the lesion side, because you have transmission on this side of the striatum and not on that side of the striatum. So the basic paradigm that Walter developed involved these stereotaxic injections of the virus, then waiting anywhere from 2 weeks to a month for the viruses to express, then injecting ivermectin systemically, IP, waiting various periods of time, and then giving a dose of amphetamine, and 10 minutes later, measuring the animals in a rotation test. And these are data summarized from a number of experiments. These are traces of animals that are recorded, but the clearest data are from watching the animals. And so in this film, this is the animal that's been injected with both subunits, the alpha and beta subunit, and has been given ivermectin. And you can see him spinning around in circles in the lower right-hand corner. The other animals, either that didn't get ivermectin or got just one of the subunits without or with ivermectin, are running around the outside of the box because amphetamine causes increased locomotor activity, but they're not circling. Now, not all of the animals do this. In fact, there's a bimodal distribution of animals that show a strong circling phenotype and a weak circling phenotype. And when Walter performed histology and looked at the expression of the chloride channels, which I forgot to mention are each tagged with a GFP variant, one with CFP and one with YFP, you can see that the animals that show a strong behavioral phenotype show a much higher level of expression and infection with the viruses than the animals that show a weak behavioral phenotype. And then to obtain independent electrophysiological evidence for silencing, Cheng Xiao, a very talented postdoc in Henry Lester's lab, who's a slice electrophysiologist, cut slices through the striatum of animals that Walter had stereotaxically injected previously with the alpha and beta viruses. And in this case, the ivermectin was perfused into the bath in which the slices were recorded from, not injected into the animal. And there was a significant population of neurons that exhibited a complete cessation of spiking activity within a few minutes after bath application of 20 nanomolar ivermectin. There's another population that shows partial inhibition, and then there's another population that shows weak inhibition, and we've correlated these electrophysiological phenotypes quantitatively with the level of expression of the channels in these neurons. And it also, the fraction of these different types of neurons correlates with the phenotype of the animals from which the slices are taken, so that animals that show a strong rotational phenotype show some degree of silencing in about 70% of the neurons that are recorded from, and of that 70%, another 70% of those show the strong silencing phenotype. And again, the stronger the behavioral phenotype, the stronger the average suppression of firing rate. So there's a good correlation between the ability of ivermectin to suppress amphetamine-induced rotation in the animal and the ability to suppress spiking activity in striatal neurons in slice culture. And finally, most importantly, Walter was able to do a heroic experiment in which he could show that repeated applications of ivermectin could cause reversible silencing and recovery in the same animal over an extended period of time. So here the animals have received a single injection of the two viruses, and then they're given ivermectin. They're tested at various times for rotation in response to amphetamine. You see the rotation phenotype come up within about 12 to 24 hours. It peaks at around 3 days, and then by about a week, it's down to baseline again. You give a second injection of ivermectin, the rotation phenotype goes up again, comes back down, not all the way to baseline, but significantly lower. And then again, a third injection of ivermectin brings the rotation phenotype back up. And when Walter sacrificed these animals and quantitatively measured the number of striatal neurons on the infected and uninfected side, there was no difference suggesting that this does not reflect any cell death caused by the ivermectin or the virus. So this suggests that with this system, we can turn the neurons off and turn them back on again in a freely behaving animal using a ligand, small molecule ligand, that can be delivered IP and crosses the blood-brain barrier. And the fact that this system requires two subunits, while might at first glance seem to make it more cumbersome, actually is advantageous because it lends itself well to intersectional strategies to increase the specificity of neuronal silencing. So, for example, if one has two genes that are both expressed in the amygdala central nucleus, but each of them is expressed at different sites outside the amygdala, if those extra amygdalar sites are non-overlapping, one could imagine using the promoter of gene A to target one subunit, that of gene B to target the other subunit, and to intercross the animals, and then only get silencing in the cells where both genes are expressed. Alternatively, one could use one subunit driven by a back transgene and provide the second subunit by stereotaxic injection of the adenovirus. And it's progress using this second method that I'll end the talk by describing to you. So one of the key requirements of this type of method is that the levels of expression of the subunits that can be achieved from a back-driven transgene are sufficiently high to promote silencing of neurons in conjunction with a virally applied subunit. In the experiments where we injected both subunits, expressed both subunits from a virus, the levels of expression are, of course, very high. And so Walter has recently performed an experiment again together with Cheng, where he's taken mice generated by Wolf Haubensack in the lab that express the alpha subunit of GluCL from the protein kinase C delta back transgene. And he's injected initially the beta subunit virus into the thalamus, again, because it's a large target and easy to hit and relatively easy to make slices from. And here are some preliminary data from Cheng showing that in slices from animals which have the transgene-driven alpha subunit and the beta subunit provided by a virus, that when ivermectin is infused into the medium, there's a strong suppression of action potential firing. The N on these experiments is still relatively small. It's about 5 cells. Not all of the controls have been done, but we're very encouraged by these results to think that it should be possible, at least in these back transgenics, to combine a transgene-driven alpha subunit with a virus-driven beta subunit in order to restrict expression to a particular subset of neurons. So in the meantime, now Wolf has been trying to use this approach to ask what are the behavioral consequences now of silencing the protein kinase C delta expressing subsets of neurons in the amygdala central nucleus. And doing that has now required stereotaxic bilateral injections of beta subunit adenovirus into the central nucleus. And as you can imagine, these are technically very difficult experiments because you have to hit spot on both sides of the animal. And so what we do is to inject many, many animals, record all the behavioral data blind, and then section all of the animals and score them for infection by the virus, and then correlate behavior with the degree of infectivity. And so the initial behavioral paradigm is one in which we simply apply the ivermectin to the virally injected animals before we perform the fear conditioning experiment. So ivermectin is present during training, and it's also present during testing, and then we do the histology. Now, as I said, the experiments that have been done up to now, although controversial, have shown that lesioning the amygdala central nucleus causes a loss of conditioned fear responses. And so that's what you might have expected by silencing a specific population of neurons in the central amygdala. In fact, what Wolf got was the opposite result. Although there's a fair amount of scatter in the data, there is clearly a statistically significant increase in the degree of conditioned freezing in animals that are in which the PKC delta neurons are silenced in the amygdala central nucleus in comparison to controls that are injected with one virus or wild type animals. So that suggests that if silencing these neurons produces an increase in conditioned fear, that the normal function of these neurons may be to suppress fear output from the amygdala. And so what evidence is there, or what is known about amygdala microcircuitry that we could use to relate to these behavioral data? So there's work from a number of labs, including Huda Akil and some of her students, Heidi Day, that have identified subpopulations of GABAergic neurons within the lateral part of the central amygdala, some expressing enkephalin, some expressing CRH. The projections of some of these neurons have been mapped, but their functional role is incompletely understood. More recently, work from Huber et al., published in Science, used slice recordings in amygdala central nucleus to demonstrate that there is a population of neurons that express Tom Insel's favorite receptor, the oxytocin receptor, that send an inhibitory projection to the medial part of the central nucleus, and that may function to gate output from this CEM structure. So we were interested in trying to relate these PKC delta neurons to the populations defined by these different markers. And so through a series of double label in situ hybridization experiments, Wolf confirmed that the PKC delta neurons are GABAergic. Interestingly, they express GAD65, the rare isoform, not GAD67. They express enkephalin, which is one of the two neuropeptides that define subsets of neurons in the lateral part of the central nucleus. They do not, interestingly, express corticotropin-releasing hormone, which is this other subset of neurons in the central nucleus. Here's staining the paraventricular nucleus as a control. And interestingly, they also express oxytocin receptor, although they are not the only neurons in the central nucleus that express the oxytocin receptor. The fact that they are in the lateral part of the central nucleus and that silencing these neurons seems to increase the behavioral expression of conditioned fear is consistent with interfering with the projection defined in slice recordings by Huber et al. And again, now to try to specifically link this into the circuit, Wolf has also performed some preliminary tracing experiments. So we were interested to know what are the outputs of the PKC delta neurons. And to do this, Wolf has combined retrograde tracing with cholerotoxin B with staining for PKC delta. So in this case, he has asked whether these PKC delta neurons in lateral CEA project to the medial part of CEA by injecting the retrograde tracer into the medial part and then doing his analysis more posteriorly away from the injection site. And you can indeed see double labeled cells, which means that at least some of these PKC delta neurons indeed project to this output nucleus of the central amygdala. Interestingly, they also project to the lateral dorsal part of the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, which is also known as the ovoid nucleus for those who read different neuroanatomy texts. Again, you can see there's back labeling of these PKC delta neurons from BST. So that suggests that these PKC delta neurons have at least two output projections, one to the medial CEA and then the other a direct projection to the BST. So if these neurons are inhibitory, which would fit with their being GABAergic, and with silencing them increasing fear, one would also like to know what are the inputs to these neurons and whether they derive from parts of the brain that are involved in processing stress coping signals or signals that are involved in anxiolytic responses. And we've just begun those experiments, but Wolf is using a tool developed by Lynn Enquist, which is a pseudorabies virus derivative that is a retrograde transsynaptic tracer that only expresses upon cre-mediated recombination. So this has a EGFP and thymidine kinase whose expression is blocked by an interruption cassette with LOXP sites. If you inject this in the vicinity of neurons that express Cre, then those neurons will recombine this out, and then the presynaptic afferents to those neurons can pick up this virus and retrogradely transport it. Again, these are preliminary data, but when we inject this into the central nucleus of the amygdala, Wolf can find retrogradely labeled neurons in perirhinal cortex, and also, interestingly, in endopiriform cortex and insular cortex. Insular cortex, in particular, is a region of the brain that's been implicated in affect and top-down regulation of amygdala responses. So these experiments need further validation and additional controls, but they give you a flavor of the type of experiments that we are trying to do now in order to link these PKC delta neurons anatomically into the microcircuit of the central nucleus, its downstream targets, and its upstream inputs. And in the future going forward, a number of questions remain that we would like to try to answer. Do these neurons regulate the acquisition or the expression of learned fear? The ability to use ivermectin in a reversible manner should allow us to give this drug before training or after training and compare the effects on conditioned fear. What is the relationship between these PKC delta neurons in the central nucleus and the lateral amygdala? We do not see any retrograde label back in the lateral nucleus, so how do we tie this subcircuit in to this supposed site at which CS-US convergence occurs? Very important experiment is a gain-of-function experiment. Is activation of PKC delta neurons sufficient to suppress fear? If we could show that using channel rhodopsin or another genetically encoded neuronal activator in an awake-behaving animal, it would represent one of the first examples of, if you will, genetically guided deep brain stimulation of an anxiolytic circuit. And then finally, what is the role of this other subpopulation of interneurons in the lateral CEA? The CRH neurons, do they act in opponency to the encephalinergic neurons? If so, where is that opponency played out, and how is it regulated by top-down inputs? And then the last question is whether these neurons only are involved in conditioned fear or whether they play a role in innate fear, such as predator responses and anxiety. And now having these transgenic animals and the ability to functionally manipulate the circuit allows us to put them through a battery of different behavioral tests and ask how general the effects of this manipulation are on different types of fear and anxiety. So, with that, I'll stop and acknowledge again the many colleagues, talented students and postdocs who have contributed to this work. The Drosophila work was spearheaded in my lab by Greg Sue, a talented postdoc who's now off to a position at the Skirball in collaboration with Seymour Benzer and Ann Simon. And all of the imaging was done in collaboration with Richard Axel by Alan Wong, who is a graduate student with Richard, and Jing Wang, a postdoc. And Nat Hines and the GenSat project were very helpful in providing us with access to back transgenesis technology. And then Henry Lester has been our ongoing collaborator in the in vivo applications of the GluCL ivermectin system. And that work has been developed by Walter Lerchner, and the applications to the amygdala and the PKC delta system developed by Wolf Haubensack. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to take any questions. I can't hear the question, sorry. Can you use the microphone?
Hi. What is your feeling about encephalin playing a role in this microcircuit in the amygdala, if there is any?
The question is whether encephalin itself plays an anxiolytic role within the amygdala. It's certainly been speculated that it does. However, not all of the PKC delta positive neurons are encephalinergic, and since those neurons are also GABAergic, it's not clear whether they exert their antagonistic influence through encephalin, through GABAergic inhibition of downstream neurons, or a combination of both. It would really require, for example, knocking out enkephalin specifically in those neurons in the amygdala and looking at the effect of that manipulation on conditioned fear, something that could be done now because this PKC delta transgene also expresses Cre recombinase.
In the fruit fly experiments, I was wondering whether you have any idea whether the CO2 channel is looking at the CO2 concentration in absolute terms, whether this is relative to background. So if the animals are conditioned in one state and then kept in a slightly higher CO2 environment,
yep,
and then moved to yet a slightly higher one, do they see that as a change?
Right, so that's a very good question. The question is whether CO2 detection in Drosophila is relative or absolute. We have not done any experiments on that ourselves. People have done those types of experiments on other insects, and I think the consensus is that it detects absolute concentrations rather than relative concentrations compared to background. But we have not tested that directly in Drosophila. I should say that there's interesting data that's been presented at meetings, maybe in press, by Kristen Scott, that says that Drosophila have an independent system for detecting CO2 with their gustatory system, and that only detects CO2 in solution, not in the gas phase, and that CO2 detection is positively valenced in that it's attractive rather than repulsive as CO2 is in the gas phase. And uses different receptor mechanism. Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention.